You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. Ila Morley grew up in South Africa during apartheid. After moving abroad and working for a decade in nonprofits, she set her first novel, Come Sunday, back in South Africa. It won the Janet Heidinger Kafka Prize and was a finalist for the Commonwealth Prize. Her new novel, Above, is set far away from South Africa in the small town of Eudora, Kansas. It's about a young girl who is kidnapped and held captive for 17 years and her daily fight to survive and stay sane in these harrowing conditions. Above is published by Gallery Books, and Ila Morley joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Ila.
Thanks for having me.
So I have to ask you, you spent a decade working in nonprofits. What kind of work were you doing?
I was working for churches and also for the YWCA of Honolulu. Mm-hmm. I was running a program where we would help women find jobs by giving them outfits. The program was called Dress for Success. And so I just got to hear about the troubles and some of the challenges that women, especially women that were coming out of prison, what they were facing, and some of their issues relating to children. And I just was drawn to their struggles and how they find inspiration against all these odds and terrible experiences, that they find a way to move forward and then eventually thrive in society.
Mm-hmm. So the YWCA of Honolulu?
I lived in Hawaii for 7 years. I know it's a tough gig.
Well, it sounds kind of good. When did you leave South Africa? How old were you and when did you?
I was 26 mm-hmm. years old. It was 1994 after the first free election. Mm-hmm. And it was right around the time when I was making speeches that I would never leave South Africa. And it was in the midst of this really amazing time. It was history in the making. Nelson Mandela was the first freely elected president. We were all inspired by his message. And so while I was grandstanding that I was not going to be like other South Africans and bail, an American showed up in my town, and I fell hopelessly in love with him.
Oh, blame it on an American.
It's always the American.
All your principles went right down the drain.
Oh, and I was married like the next week. Well, it was a little bit longer, but I just threw caution to the wind, and I followed him halfway across the world. Mm-hmm. I left my family and my job and my whole life and started anew in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up in South Africa during the apartheid years?
Well, I don't know that it would be any different from any other average American childhood. I lived in a bubble. Mm-hmm. I was born to a middle-class family, and we lived in the suburbs of a big city. We lived in Johannesburg. And I wasn't really aware of apartheid. I had a sense as a young child that blacks and whites were treated differently because the maid would come and wash and clean our clothes, but she had special dishes that she ate from, not our dishes, and she couldn't use the inside bathroom. So there were those kinds of things, but I didn't really question it. I was more aware of the antagonism and the racism between whites, between English-speaking and Afrikaans-speaking whites. Mm-hmm. And then just kind of very isolated. Politically, the censorship board had the country by the throat. Mm-hmm. So the first time I ever heard of Nelson Mandela was after I graduated from college, and I was walking around in London and I saw picketers outside the South African embassy that said, "Free Mandela." And I thought, well, who's Mandela? But there was an event that happened to me when I was 13 years old that just kind of removed the veil of what had been in my country and affected me personally about how apartheid causes rifts at every level, even a 13-year-old.
Could you share that with me? You're teasing me with that.
Well, we moved from Johannesburg to Port Elizabeth, and for 1 year, I was in a convent school, and it was all-girls school, and for the first time, black kids were in my class. And I had this girl, Zola, who was sitting in front of me, and she and I were both mischievous, and we had an instant connection. And this developing friendship, you know, wanted bounds outside of the classroom. So we would, we talked about getting together. And I went to my mom and I said, "We want to go to the movies." And my mom said, "No, you can't go to, there's, you know, cinemas for whites and there's cinemas for blacks." So I said, "Well, okay, we want to go to the beach." Well, then I was told that there were white beaches and there were black beaches. And then we talked about maybe her coming to my house or me going to her house. And that was just impossible because it was very dangerous for whites to go into black neighborhood and vice versa. And there was a time when there was Group Areas Act that was still enforced, that blacks needed permission to come into white neighborhoods. And so the injustice that the government could dictate who I could be friends with was something that just resounded very strongly. It caused a huge rift in my family. And in a way, those kinds of themes of injustice and friendship against racial lines continue to influence me and crop up in my writing.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have family in South Africa?
I do. I have a lot of family. I just discovered a whole new branch of family because I was adopted at 5 days old. And I've just recently made contact with my biological father.
Oh,
comes to find out that I have 6 siblings, one of them in New York City. She's an amazing musician and composer, and I just had the good fortune of spending a couple of hours with her last night.
How did you make touch with your birth family?
I had known through a social worker what his name was, and I kept his name for 5 years. I didn't want to impose. I didn't want anything from him, but eventually I just felt like I wanted to send him a message that I was okay and I'd had a wonderful life and was happy, and to thank him for what must have been a very difficult decision. And I had a friend call him up, and he was gracious enough to say that he would like to receive a letter. And so we have this marvelous epistolary relationship going on. I've not heard his voice, and I'm looking forward to meeting him one day.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking to the novelist Isla Morley. She won awards for her first novel, Come Sunday, and she has a new book out called Above from Gallery Books. So have you, we will talk to you, talk about your book in a moment, but I'm riveted to this South African story. Have you been back to South Africa much since 1994?
I used to go about once every year, and that was when my adoptive family, they were still alive, and they passed away in the last 10 years. So the impetus is really gone. For me, it was going back to family, and so now finding my new family, my lost tribe, if you will, that gives me a reason to go back again.
Mm-hmm. Do you have much of a sense of what South Africa is? What its prospects are like? It's in this post-Mandela era now, and there's a lot of concern about, you know, where it goes from here. Do you have any feelings about that? I mean, you must have feelings, but what's your assessment, if any?
I do. I hear negative things primarily, and when I was growing up there, you know, there was a lot of negativity as well. And there's a sense in which I feel like I don't have a right to talk about it anymore because I haven't lived there for 20 years.
Sure.
But what I can say is that over and over, especially researching for my novel Above, I've seen individuals or communities, you know, even whole nations that have been subjected to suffering and to awful atrocities and yet, against all odds, find a way to rise above.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Above a little bit now. This book has a lot of twists and turns, and I don't want to give away any spoilers. That's the whole point of reading. You know, you want to enjoy the surprises. But can you basically describe what happens to your heroine, Blythe, in the book?
She's almost 17 years old when she's abducted. And the character that takes her away from the horse thieves' picnic is a survivalist. She's one of those extreme preppers who believes that the end of the world is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he has made preparations for this event for years. And he takes her to an abandoned Atlas F missile silo in the middle of a cornfield. And this huge engineering marvel that plummets 200, 300 feet into the ground. And he keeps her captive in there, along with all his seed catalogs. He calls it the Ark because he's got DNA of just about every creature known to man. He's got copies of historical documents like the Declaration of Independence. He's got a massive seed catalog. So his idea is to keep her there until it's safe to go above after the apocalypse and, in his view, seed the new world because he now has a young woman of sound womb.
Mm-hmm.
And it's her struggle to obviously, first to escape, And then she has to deal with his encroaching madness. And then nothing prepares her for when she has to raise a child in those circumstances, when she has to create a fable in order to make it so that her son is not a captive like she is, but believes that they are one day going to get out. And so the story is a lot to do with when myth and reality collide.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in South Africa. You moved to Los Angeles, and your book is set in Eudora, Kansas. How did you decide on this as a setting for a book and survivalists? I mean, we know about survivalists, but you must have done a tremendous amount of research to get into the world of survivalists and what they're thinking. How did you do this?
Well, it's interesting because I don't fit in anywhere. I don't belong in South Africa anymore. You know, as soon as I open my mouth, I identify myself as an outsider, even though I'm a U.S. citizen. And I don't know, I think I'm drawn to those characters and stories that highlight the outsider experience. Mm-hmm. So this character, this Dobbs Horden guy, he's not the run-of-the-mill sexual pervert that we've come to expect with abduction stories. I mean, he's got a mindset that the end of the world is about to happen. When I went and researched online, you know, it runs the gamut. There's survivalists who are, you know, whack jobs, and then there's somebody like Dobbs who follows the science. And right now we're seeing some of that science. The UN panel on climate change just last week was talking about, the peril that we're in. And it's scary when survivalists on chat forums call us sitting ducks. That's one thing. But then when scientists are quoted and saying we're sitting ducks, I mean, that's cause for alarm. So I spent a lot of time going into that world, and ask me anything about an arsenal and what gun will shoot what person at close range, I can tell you.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Isla Morley, the author of a new novel called Above, which is set in the small town of Eudora, Kansas, about a young girl who was kidnapped and held captive for 17 years by a survivalist. Were there any true stories of abduction that you used as the basis for this, or was it? Did you find sort of a composite of true? Were there any? I guess my question is: were there any sort of recurring themes in the true stories that were useful to you?
Well, this story was inspired by that headline that happened in Austria a few years ago with the abduction of Elizabeth Fritzl, mm-hmm. and it came to light that her father had kept her in the cellar.
The dungeon, yeah.
Right. And nobody else knew about it, and she was kept there for 24 years. Ended up having 6 children, 3 of which she raised in confinement, and the oldest one was 18 years. So when I read that story, I was a mother of a young child at that point, and I was drawn to the theme to what extent a mother would sacrifice for her child. So I knew instinctively I wanted to write about a character who would, rather than tell the truth about the circumstances of why they were held underground, she would create a lie. Mm-hmm. You know, we often think that we all have to go on facts, but it's fiction that sustains us. It's stories that keep us alive. They keep mm-hmm. the fire burning within us. And that's what I wanted to capture for this main character, Blythe. And to look at what's the interesting thing that's going to happen when her son gets a glimpse of reality and finds out the world that his mother has created and narrated for him is nothing like what's really happening.
I think Ray Bradbury, I think, had some great line. Of course, he was a great fantasist because he wrote all these great sci-fi books, but I think he had a line that was something like, to fantasize is to survive. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe to survive is to fantasize. But I think I maybe got it right the first time. But it's interesting as a parent. I mean, I've got kids. You're a mother. To a certain extent, we have to create fantasies for our children in order to make the world palatable. I mean, they don't have to know everything all at once. Do you find as a mother that's been something that you've had to do? I mean, the kid doesn't come right out the chute and you say, okay, here's the deal. People are going to disappoint you.
Absolutely.
Life's going to be, the universe is indifferent. You don't say that stuff.
No, you have to protect that sense of wonder that they're born with. And my daughter's 12 now, and she's just now being exposed to some of the realities, but there's still this this urgency that I have to kind of protect her and shield her. And how do you do that? So, I mean, even with simple things like the tooth fairy, I think she believed in the tooth fairy until last week, honestly. And the same with Santa. I mean, do we really want to tell children? I hope there's no children listening. But
I shouldn't think so.
But do we really want to tell them that great fantasy is all just made up stuff?
Right.
No. And for ourselves, I mean, often when we've gone through difficult things or a friend has gone through a difficult thing, we tell ourselves stories. We share our own personal experiences and we narrate them in sometimes fictionalized ways to mm-hmm. give hope and to inspire somebody to carry on, to fight the good fight and to stand up for the good.
So in your story, really, and it's kind of the story of, in a weird way, of every family, you have kind of a hostage situation within a hostage situation, because the mom is her own kind of, you know, she is her own kind of hostage taker, because she is telling her son what her son, she thinks her son needs to know. So it's fascinating how you kind of create that, as you put it, the fable within the, you know, within the insanity of their own captivity here,
which makes for great conflict, because mm-hmm. you always want to set up those kinds of examples where there's conflict. And I think again with the parenting thing, we are going to face our children's wrath when they discover that we haven't prepared them enough or given enough of the truth for them.
Mm-hmm. Do you, as your child is 12?
Yes.
She on the internet much? She
no,
on
that's one of the areas where I protect her.
So you are a hostage taker after all. You're controlling information.
I confess.
That's probably a very good decision, though. I think that would probably be hard to do, hard in a lot of families to do that, to control that information to the kids. But I know from, I don't have a 12-year-old child. My daughter is 4. But I do know from hearing other parents who have middle school age kids that being on the internet, being on Facebook especially, is incredibly punishing, that they're just, you know, have this daily onslaught, this assessment of how popular or hated they are, and it's a really tough thing. How long do you think you're going to be able to hold out and fight that good fight as a mother?
Well, we're going into the bunker next week. I don't know. I think the best thing to do is to talk to your children. And that's mm-hmm. what we do. Emily and I have a lot of conversations, because one day she'll be having to set those boundaries for herself.
Mm-hmm. So are you off to work on a new book now, or what's your...
I am working on a novel. When I started writing my first book, come Sunday, I literally wrote in a closet. And I think
so you like confined spaces.
What can I say? Me and survivalists. But that's a good metaphor for how I write. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just a very private, personal experience, because I know that sometimes writing goes off in different directions, and sometimes you have to give yourself permission to fail. So I can tell you it's a story, and there are people in it.
That's good. Thanks. You're sort of controlling information the way you do with your 12-year-old daughter. I appreciate that. I've been speaking with Isla Morley about her new novel, Above. It's published by Gowrie Books. And Isla, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure to be here.